Well, I'd love to, you know, kind of get that Dallas connection out the way. I'm guessing it starts with, is it you met Craig Cosgrove? Cosgray or
That's right. That's right. I met Craig Cosgrave back in 1999. He was a pilot for Delta Airlines, and he flew me in on one of his buddy passes, and he took me to a neighborhood in Dallas called Addison, and it was a really cool sort of artsy, nice restaurants, bars, and everything. And we spent the next couple of years building up a home video company called Marengo Films. And at that point, you know, I had some experience with managing my family's film archive. As a little kid, I inherited my family's 16-millimeter collection in the mid-70s that my uncle and his family had been maintaining since the 1920s. And so I had an AV sort of film cinephile background when I met Craig, and he had made this film called The Cavalrymen, and he was trying to get it distributed and raise money. And we ended up forging a partnership to re-release a lot of old public domain films on the new format, which is going to be the new cutting edge and change the world, called DVD. And we did that for a couple of years, and some of the inherent challenges with growth and competition became apparent that we needed to sort of change the plan. I went off, formed a company that became known as eventually Mill Creek Entertainment. We introduced the multiple movie mega packs that pretty much destroyed the catalog business and major retailers that were looking just to, you know, kind of merchandise lots of stuff in a box. And I did not like that approach at all, so I sold out of that company to the company that ultimately changed the name to Mill Creek. And I spent the next 10, 15 years just amassing content all over the world, you know, buying up libraries, working with independent rights holders, going to trade shows all over the world, you know, in France and the Netherlands and Vegas. And I realized that, you know, the home video business was changing. About 2006, 2007, we were seeing all these emerging digital initiatives like Hulu and Amazon Video Direct and all that. And thankfully, at that point, we had amassed so much content from DVD and early Blu-ray releases that we were able to become early adopters of the digital protocol, which was something that the studios didn't want to do because they were too busy chasing the old revenue, and none of these companies were paying any minimum guarantees. So we get into streaming, you know, probably 10 years, you know, before most people did, who came out of the old world as kind of home video physical goods. And we were able to see a lot of growth success with Hulu, who back then, you know, they had an incredible appetite for older content. That changed eventually when they realized that they were paying the lion's share of their money to third-party rights holders. And they started realizing they had their own audience, they could build out their own distribution, and Hulu and Amazon became their own studios. So less interest in old movies, less interest in independent movies. And then you have these sort of new initiatives like these sort of Pluto TV and Tubi TV, which were kind of replacing the appetite for older catalog independent content. And certainly, Fandor was an early adopter of that too. But what Fandor did, which most didn't, was they had a great editorial team. They would contextualize all the films, you know, foreign films, indie films, classic films, with great editorial content. And that was the sort of bridge to me that was missing, was the engagement that didn't exist before. You know, with people just putting up a bunch of streaming content, you'd go to a website and you just get lost in the sea of, you know, titles that just had no rhyme or reason to them. So the opportunity, when we started delivering our own content as the Film Detective, we realized that there's tremendous void in the streaming landscape in terms of indie films and classic films. Even though some great attempts are made, by people like Turner with the launch of Filmstruck and some other platforms, you know, like Criterion and some of the sort of less renowned ones, like Mubi, who were trying to get into it. There was still no major initiative around it with the editorial. And Fandor had fallen out of their investment dollars a few years ago. They had approached me 2 years ago to try to come in and help resurrect the company, and I took the asset around along with the film detective, you know, and I knocked on a lot of doors and tried to find a good vertical fit, a partner, and fortunately, Cinedigm came to the table. They totally believed in what we were talking about with classic movies, with independent films, with, you know, just sort of the engagement opportunities with editorial, with bloggers, and we were able to make the transaction right shortly after we sold our company to them. So it's been an amazing ride in the past few months, considering that, you know, the country's in a lockdown right now and we're in the midst of this kind of tumultuous time in the country. But the streaming of content and the consumption of content online is really quite high. So I think that we've got a good opportunity to kind of be a voice in the landscape of, you know, independent digital content by building an arsenal of these niche channel opportunities to the market. So that's sort of the long and the short, going way back to Addison, Texas.
So cool. To give you another kind of rundown memory lane, do you mind if I ask about another classic film element to your life? I read in an interview that your first date with your wife was a classic film moment as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. God, I'm trying to put everything in perspective. So in the timeline, we're talking about, Marenko was 99, so that would have been 93, which is too much perspective. As I look at the reality of almost 30 years, but yeah, no, we went on one of our first dates to see The Night of the Hunter, and I knew I said anyone that is excited and willing to go sit through a film like this and still want to go on another date with me is definitely a keeper.
So one of the things you brought up when you were talking about the timeline of things and. You brought up, you know, the importance of editorializing the material. And one of the things I noticed in Cinedigm's purchase of Fandor and, of course, of the Film Detective, I'm curious, it says the relaunch of Keyframe. And I'm curious if there are other, can you talk a bit about that, but also about the importance of people not just watching these classic films, but commenting, talking, and keeping, you know, the lifeblood of these classic films alive through editorializing what they are about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, in 2021, so many people are engaged with social media in terms of whatever their passions are in life. And classic movies are, you know, a huge part of that in our culture. And the generational bridge to classic movies is oftentimes through editorial and editorializing through social. So Keyframe, you know, which was a great concept, really was the bridge to kind of the audience in terms of education and engagement with, you know, kind of very impassioned group of bloggers or editors or journalists who love classic movies, some of which are, you know, well-known journalists, others are just kind of armchair journalists who are very engaged with the community. And I think that for us, you know, we look at our fandom of kind of cinephile world where people still love to go online and comment, whether it's on YouTube or Twitter or Facebook, on all these great films. And when we're re-releasing a movie that we've recently restored on Blu-ray or on DVD, you have this entire enthusiastic group who are waiting to get re-engaged and you know, that's sort of another opportunity, you know, where, you know, you have an old film that gets kind of restored, and then it's a new project to talk about. It's sort of you're re-engaging people with the film again. And then you have an editorial calendar, you know, like right now we're coming up on Black History Month, and there's such a treasure trove of African-American films going back to August Grimisho all the way up, you know, through, you know, newer films of Spike Lee that have an amazing pedigree, but with an important narrative that, you know, unless you're kind of plugged into that sort of side of cinema history, you're not going to necessarily know about all these sort of great long-lost films that were shown in many areas in segregated times, where there'd be films shown in these theaters that were in Harlem or the Midnight Ramble screenings. So, you know, you have to look at the prism through history with historic perspective, and I think that's the sort of the engagement that's missing now, and that's why you don't have as much interest in some of the lesser known classic movies. But you do see a tremendous amount of interest in films when they're contextualized, especially with people who are kind of authorities on film and that are not necessarily famous, but just really smart about the subject matter. And there's constantly bloggers and journalists talking about film 24/7 all over the world. And there's Bollywood. There's, you know, all the great Japanese, you know, directors. There's all the British films. There's even a great segment of films, you know, that were made in Egypt that not many people know about or have seen. So I think Fandor and Keyframe is going to be the bridge to the classic film community. And on a global basis, you know, we're streaming is all over the world, and, you know, your content editorial can be read or interpreted all over the world. We're going to try to expand what Fandor originally did, and they did it early on too. So, you know, the success of the technology wasn't fully there when they launched this over a decade ago. So I think that there's definitely a need, because there's a void in the market for this stuff, but there's also an opportunity to kind of group together and syndicate content and kind of publish content with a network of fans. And I think that's where Keyframe and Fandor will really be successful in the coming years.
I'd love to pick your brain, Phil, about the advancement in technology that you're talking about, especially, I mean, back, you know, way back in the day when you were, you know, restoring, you know, an Orson Welles film compared to what you're capable of doing today. How important is the technological gain to not only just restoring these great libraries of film, but restoring them to a level that we can have them for so much longer and into the future? I mean, I feel like classic film can be so much more captured right now than any period of time we've ever been able to you know, restore it.
You're exactly right. This I look back, you know, 20 plus years ago when we started transferring film on a telecine and converting it to tape, you know, a beta tape. So, you know, we would take a film, clean it, run it through a telecine, and make a beta tape. And then the beta tape got encoded to a digital MPEG file. Now, the compression in 1999 and 2000 versus 2021, with the size of the media files you can get with 2K and 4K for the same films, is staggering in terms of the different amount of information that you have to work with. So the resolution is so much greater than it was 21, 22 years ago. And the audience obviously appreciates getting better looking material, because it's like seeing a film, you know, with brand new eyes once it's been restored from good material. And the cost to do that 20 years ago was enormous. The technology was nowhere near as sophisticated as it is today, and the appetite for consumption online was nowhere near what it is today. So this is going to be a renaissance in terms of how much content can get restored and pushed out into a pipeline again. And I think that, you know, for us, that's really exciting, because if people still want to get physical media, you know, there is a small section of the revenue that relies on re-releasing films on Blu-ray or Ultra HD. But most of the studios don't see that revenue as being meaningful enough to want to spend the money on a lot of lesser-known films. So they licensed off most of their back catalog libraries to home video companies that are still out there, but they're keeping those assets as digital because they know that that's going to be a valuable proposition into the future. So I think that, you know, like MGM and Universal and Paramount are all going to have way better looking content. Now, you know, a lot of this content has come out on Blu-ray or Ultra HD. And in many cases, they're not even releasing it. They're giving it to third parties just so they can get the HD material for streaming and broadcast right now. So I think that it's great whenever you can work with new material and upgrade it from the previous looking version. And in regards to, you know, what we could do 10 years ago or 20 years ago today, it's night and day from a cost perspective and from an operational perspective and a technological perspective. It's just the tools are so much greater.
Wow, it's fascinating. One element you brought up that I want to touch upon also, you were talking about the international look at film, and you mentioned obviously like the Japanese great history in film, and obviously Bollywood and its huge expanse of film. But you also brought up Egypt. I saw a great documentary that talked about the silent film era in Egypt. How important is it now that you've, you know, been able to connect with CineDime to look at places around the world that haven't necessarily had a focus on them, like Egypt or smaller countries that had very vibrant film, not just catalogs, but even, I mean, there were studios, there was whole movement in the Egyptian world. Can you talk about finding those kind of hidden gems and how there still are so many films out there that we just haven't rediscovered or you know, been able to relaunch?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the, you know, the cinephile film community knows that there are so many great films that are out there all over the world. Egypt had a renaissance, you know, of a glamorous Hollywood-esque movement, you know, when they had their sort of amazing awakening of getting into motion pictures. And most of the world, certainly very few broadcasters, with the exception of Turner, have shown any deep dive foreign classic movies. But I think that the Fandor audience and the audience, you know, from the Film Detective, is really going to have an appreciation for all these countries' back catalogs that don't get a lot of exposure. You can get into films like films that were made in the Philippines. There's a tremendous amount of interesting films, horror movies in particular, that came out of the Philippines in the 60s and the 70s. And there's even some great British noir that, even though we know of a lot of British films, you know, we think mostly of kind of the Hammer films as horror movies. Hammer made a lot of noir films before they were known for their kind of Technicolor, you know, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, you know, various incarnations of Dracula and Frankenstein. There was a great catalog of noir titles. So we're going to be celebrating all things on a global basis and trying to, you know, again, through Keyframe, bring some contextual education to really explain, you know, why these titles were important, why they're interesting, and how they would be appealing to someone looking for new content that they haven't seen that might be 80 or 90 years old.
About CineDime's importance, you said that you were, when Fandor approached you, you started looking at companies, and then Cinedigm has obviously been the company to bring all this together. How important has it been to meet people that are still so interested in this? Like, I'm curious, as far as your growth in the film detective, seeing where it can now go, having even more connection with Cinedigm and Fandor's great catalog. How important is it, and how cool is it to see that there are still so many more connections people can have, and it's not just one or two places where people can find classic film, that there are so many lovers of that realm that are out there?
It's awesome. I mean, Cinedigm completely gets it. They totally have the independent spirit. They support it. They believe in it. They're in a financial position to sustain it. And I think it's great timing. So we were really lucky to find a partner that really had our that shared our enthusiasm for the vision of independent cinema and being a voice for independence.
Hmm. One of the things you brought up was, you know, next month it will be a look at Black History Month, and that being something cool that every month with the Film Detective, and you do, you know, like this month's classic comedy. Can you talk about picking each month's theme, but also finding the correct films and that process? How much fun is it? How much fun is it to, you know, showcase films that people may know, and then obviously films that you may find and slip in there that people may not have seen or known?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the way we program is just, you know, pretty much an editorial calendar. So just like you would if you were a TV network or even a publication, there's anniversaries, there's, you know, there's birthdays, there's themes within holidays. So the calendar cycle really is sort of fun in the way that there's so much to pull from. And one of the challenges is to not be predictable, and certainly predictable is sort of the path of least resistance. You know, you can show, you know, your sort of like your mainstream romantic comedies, even if they're classics or even if they're kind of new classics, and get the eyeballs. I mean, that's what the broadcasters do. They just need to sustain the Nielsen ratings. But when you're an OTT independent, you don't have as much pressure to get the same content as everyone else and chase the same viewership. You can engage differently. And that's where the social media and the editorial really comes in handy. So if we take a chance on a lesser known film that is going to be supported by an editorial team, and we can get that out to a message that is going to be featured on our platform, we have a lot more engagement. And I think the blogger network that we have built and we're continuing to add to is really critical in terms of engagement for some of the lesser known films that people don't know about. A good example is we just got through doing a Betty White birthday celebration. She turned 99. And her early TV career is really interesting. I mean, she was a trailblazer, you know, when she was in Life with Elizabeth and Date with the Angels. But how many stations are showing that? I don't think anyone. And it's great TV. It's really fun. Another example is in terms of early TV, we just licensed from the daughter of Buddy Hackett, Carol Burnett's first TV series called Stanley.
Wow.
I mean, who's showing that? It's Carol Burnett when she's really young, and no one really has seen it. So I think that, you know, the fun part is it's TV, it's shorts, it's feature films, it's animation, it's documentaries, and there's so much in this stuff. There's so much history all over the world. And gluing it all together in a cohesive way is really fun, and it's challenging, but it also justifies kind of what we do. And this opportunity is just sort of, you know, it's a dream. It's a dream because we couldn't survive putting out DVDs and Blu-rays any longer. No one can. That's in the rearview mirror. But, you know, now with the streaming kind of existence that we have, you can supplement your income with that, but you can also look at that as a way of kind of keeping people really, in terms of having a Blu-ray, that's sort of a wonderful thing, because some people want to have collectibles. They want maybe a deluxe edition with a booklet, with, you know, kind of other things. And I think, you know, as your success builds, you can take chances like that. You can put out deluxe versions of things. I know that there's so many people that still buy vinyl records, and they said that vinyl was going to be dead 25 years ago. And look, it's eclipsed CD sales now. So you just never know in terms of what people are going to want, why they want it. But what we do know is they have tremendous passion for all these things related to cinema history. And I think that with what we're doing with Fandor, we're going to be able to sort of take advantage of the timing of the technology and where it is right now. And while everyone else is chasing the mainstream, we'll be a voice to the independents, and they don't have to say, if I don't get on Netflix, I'm never going to recoup the cost of what it took to make my film. So that should never be an obstacle. You shouldn't have to just make a film only for Netflix. You should have the ability to get it out there to an audience of people that appreciate and want to go deep into it, and that's why there's room for other platforms. And that's great, too, because it allows everyone to coexist. I mean, it would really stink if you had, you know, one or two TV stations. So, you know, we're in a similar position when the golden age of cable TV started. That's the sort of the new paradigm shift. The streaming platforms, and now they're kind of their own cable networks within themselves.
So important. To kind of wrap things up, Phil, you brought up the fact that you know, things are changing. Obviously, COVID is another obstacle that's completely killing off certain elements of viewing, not just classic film, but any type of film, especially what it's doing to the theater world, or keeping theaters open. You've always been someone who's been able to look to the future and see avenues of gaining success in showing film. Where do you see post-COVID the film world? Obviously, I think streaming is going to be your answer, but I'm curious, what is the next step that needs to be made to keep film alive, as we're seeing, you know, theatrically being an option that is even more of an obstacle now than it ever has been? And like you said, with Netflix kind of owning a big market share, are you hopeful that there will be a resurgence in streaming through all different types of avenues because people can't go see film? Is that going to be a weird positive gain?
Well, it certainly changed things. I mean, I think every filmmaker that had an idea that didn't get to produce their film is going to be extremely motivated when we can get back into the world safely. But we also learned a lot, too. We learned that people can engage at home and produce content and interact with people through technology. So Zoom showed us we can still have an audience with people who are captivated by a subject. So maybe things just look different. Maybe the way films are made in 2020 reflect more of kind of the environment that we had to live through. And certainly that will be a narrative going forward with whatever else kind of comes out of this. This will be a time in history that we will eventually see as a narrative on the screen at some point. So I think the lockdown told us that we needed to have comfort food and some form of escapism, and that's where we saw everyone sort of watching old vintage films to sort of get away from the news cycle, because we're bombarded with the news cycle for the past, you know, 4 years. And I think entertainment is always, you know, through every turmoil, you know, in time, we've look to entertainment as a way of kind of healing and escaping and moving on and being inspired and all those things. So I think that, you know, being a filmmaker myself, having, you know, gone into the world of documentaries and stories and narratives, there's a lot of good stories to tell right now. And you can do that, you know, for not a lot of money. There's so much available in terms of editing and what you can do with your phone or with a digital camera. So I think there's going to be a treasure trove of content that people are going to be, you know, inspired to make. And I think we're going to look back at this as an interesting transition again, you know, just in terms of what consumption looks like and what people actually consider to be their kind of their new media, their new medium for the media. And it's going to be different. I think even when you look at some of the films that would maybe have been remade as remakes get turned into things like web series or episodic series. I think it's just new iterations of different, you know, kind of ways to approach it. So I think it's going to be still some time between now and the theaters getting fully back into being open. I know that we missed, you know, we went to Turner's Film Festival every single year, so it was heartbreaking to miss it last year. It's going to be heartbreaking to miss it again this year, but hopefully in 2022 things like film festivals will be back, and there'll be a lot of enthusiasm to go back and be with people, because even though there's a lot of consumption online, the enthusiasm for going to something as an event is still there. I mean, I've been to hundreds of screenings of classic films at Turner, and they're packed with everyone from children to the elderly for films that were made 80 or 90 years ago. And this is sort of the spirit that will continue on, and we'll be out of this at some point. Drive-in movie theaters came out of, you know, this as well. You had a new way to kind of get out. A lot of films were shown outside. So regardless of how much sort of disruption has been out there, the ability to still create ways to screen films has shown that this is going to continue for a very long time in just different ways. I mean, you know, how often do you sit there with the TV in the background looking at your phone, looking up a film on IMDb that you're curious about? We've got totally multiple device technology that allows us to engage while watching. And I think that, you know, that's sort of, it just shows how engaged we are with media. And, but I am looking forward to sitting in a dark theater without the glowing phones and just disappearing into the big screen soon. I'd be lying if I said I didn't miss that.
Well, I definitely agree with that. And Phil, I love the optimism. I'm there with you. And, congratulations on Cinedigm bringing The Film Detective and Fandor to a new stage, I hope. And thank you for the time. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. And thanks for reminding me about my time in Dallas.
Awesome. Well, you can always visit us. We love film down here. And Phil, have a great 2021 into 2022.
You too. Thanks so much, and stay in touch.
Awesome. Thanks.